Leland had to make the request through the district attorney's office, but Denise could not prevent him from doing so. A grand jury investigation required Denise to present evidence of a specific crime against a specific defendant. Should the grand jury indict Ted Kennedy, Denise would be stuck with prosecuting the case. To head off the grand jury and retain control over the case, if it should come to that, Denise was exploring his options at one of the many meetings we had about this matter. On Monday morning, July 28th, Armand Fernandez recalled. Eddie thought he should have gone in at the beginning, but George Killen countered with, "Let's handle this like we handle all other accidents. Let's leave it to the local police." And George had prevailed, until the speech. Had those attending the party at Chappaquiddick talked to police, instead of sneaking off Martha's Vineyard, no further investigation would have been necessary, Fernandez said. The effort to conceal the party, and what had gone on before and after the accident, was what brought about all the suspicion in the case. A judicial inquest had been talked about in the newspapers, but nobody knew how to go about getting one. Denise assigned Lance Garth to research the statutes on inquests. A former New Bedford police officer attending law school, Garth was employed in the district attorney's office as indictments clerk. Denise also discussed his dilemma with famed criminal attorney F. Lee Bailey, a friend. "We talked about this entire situation, which was unfolding at the time," Bailey recalled. "At first, Ed kind of dropped the thing. It was an automobile accident, and he was trying to stay out of it. And the press didn't like that very much. Ed was kind of complaining that he was trying to do the right thing, but he had a Hobson's choice. Denise would be criticized no matter what he did." An inquest was the only procedure short of a grand jury or a trial in which testimony under oath could be obtained, Lance Garth reported on Tuesday morning. Used when questions arose about the circumstances of a death, an inquest was conducted by a judge with the power to subpoena witnesses, hear testimony under oath, and consider investigative reports. The judge made a finding of facts as to how the person met his death and reported to the superior court whether criminal proceedings were warranted. The judge's determination could be accidental death, criminal negligence, conspiracy to hide facts, or the report could draw no conclusions at all. If the judge found fault, such as negligence, and the person charged in the report with the commission of a crime was at large, the magistrate shall issue process for his arrest. If the judge found murder, manslaughter, or assault had been committed, he could bind over for appearance in court on a criminal case such witnesses as he considered necessary, or as the district attorney designated. But the district attorney was not bound by anything the judge found. The inquest report could be used as a basis for bringing a case before the grand jury or be ignored, and that suited Denise just fine. The procedure allowed the case to be reopened, but for Denise to maintain a hands-off position and let the judicial process pursue an investigation. George Killen demanded to know what crime Denise was seeking to prove by asking for an inquest. Denise wasn't looking to hang a rap on Ted Kennedy. He was considering an inquest in order to gain access to witnesses who had attended the party. If people had submitted sworn statements at the time of the accident, the purpose of a new investigation would be questionable. Denise was considering entering the case because the press is on my back to do something. "To hell with the press," Killen said. "Look what they did to Arena. And all he was trying to do was cooperate." Whatever questions remained about the accident, and Killen agreed there were plenty of them, it wasn't a case of any kind. Unsatisfactory as the explanation of the accident was, it was likely to be all Ted Kennedy and his friends were prepared to say about it. Kennedy was going to resume his Senate seat. The controversy was bound to die down. Why revive it? Killen couldn't stay on at the meeting. He was escorting a possible accomplice in the Costa murders to Boston to undergo lie detector tests. The Costa case and the death of Mary Jo Kopechne were vying for attention not only in Killen's office, but on the front pages of Massachusetts newspapers. Two sensational investigations running concurrently. Costa was scheduled to go to trial in September. Killen had 169 other cases to prepare for the special criminal sitting of Superior Court. He wasn't interested in reopening an investigation into the Kennedy accident. Killen said, "We don't prosecute all the cases we know about." That Killen was downgrading the Kennedy case and counseling Denise to stay out of it was good advice in the opinion of Frank Keating, Killen's friend and himself an ex-assistant district attorney. George had so much pride. He was far more interested in making sure Denise didn't look like a goddamn fool and therefore humiliate the office George had such a big part of. I don't think in his wildest Boy Scout dreams George ever thought Ted Kennedy was going to give out enough evidence of willful, wanton, and reckless conduct to amount to a manslaughter case. The clamor in the press for a new investigation had been brought about by the mismanagement of the case by Kennedy's advisors. There was Ted Kennedy, surrounded by sycophants, people who wanted to please him. Had one person controlled his attention, it should have been Bob Clark. He was the motor vehicles expert. He'd tried a million of these cases. He knew them backwards and forwards. It was probably the only case Clark wouldn't have his way with a client, because he's dealing with a Kennedy. And with those Washington people, and Ted Kennedy being no lawyer himself, the ball just got fumbled. Keating thought the speech so ill-advised. I couldn't watch it. I was just so ashamed of that whole approach. Killen was politically neutral about wanting to keep the district attorney's office away from the Kennedy accident. But Denise was a different breed altogether. A pure political animal, Keating said. I could just see Eddie Denise trembling with the possibilities of the thing. Killen was not the only one in the district attorney's office opposed to a new investigation of the Kennedy accident. Assistant District Attorney Joseph Harrington, brother of New Bedford's mayor, threatened to resign. He said, "I won't have anything to do with it. I'll leave." Denise did not consult First Assistant Peter Gay, who ran the office administratively and issued all cases. "Eddie knew better than to ask me because he knew I'd say not to do it," Gay said. Gentlemanly, soft-spoken, an experienced trial lawyer with a successful private practice in Taunton, Gay was a former campaign secretary for John Kennedy. As a delegate to the state Democratic Convention in 1962, he'd been offered a judgeship and other inducements to change his vote to Edward McCormick. Gay had taken an active part in swinging Bristol County to support Ted Kennedy's endorsement. Jimmy Smith was not aware of the meetings in New Bedford. When he heard about them, my personal reaction was, I wanted to stay the hell away from it. All the assistants agreed. Joe Harrington, Roddy Sullivan, Ernie Rottenberg. No way did we want anything to do with an inquest. We said, we're out of it, let those guys go with it. Denise only trusted Armand Fernandez anyway. It was the Portuguese connection. Modest, hardworking, content to remain in the shadow of the flamboyant Denise, Fernandez was the only assistant in the district attorney's office without political ambitions, he said. I only wanted to be a lawyer. If Denise was finding his decision to enter the case difficult, indecisiveness was epidemic at the Kennedy compound, the machinery of public relations faltering in the face of overwhelming editorial hostility. The election returns were winning emotional public support, but Kennedy's too contrived, too blatantly emotional speech had done him more harm than good with political professionals and the press. Kennedy had left so many questions unanswered about the accident. No fair assessment could be made about his resignation. It had been as indefensible for him not to have offered a full explanation for the accident as it was not to have reported it in the first place. With so many questions still hanging over him, it was questionable how effective Kennedy would be in the Senate. A decision to field a creditable candidate to challenge Kennedy's seat in 1970 had been made before the accident. Republican State Chairman Josiah Spaulding didn't know whether his party's chances of defeating Ted Kennedy had been enhanced by the accident at Chappaquiddick. It could hurt his image, but I wouldn't want to beat him on this basis, Spaulding said. Senator Kennedy's situation is not a partisan matter. One can only feel great personal sympathy for him. But there are a great many questions involved, some of which may never be answered. Eventually, he is going to have to make speeches and demonstrate his ability to lead. Spaulding's analysis wasn't taken very seriously. Political observers doubted Kennedy could be defeated in Massachusetts no matter what he did, because he was a Kennedy and could get away with anything, even the death of a young woman under mysterious circumstances. The real damage to his career was as a national leader. Kennedy's post-accident behavior had permanently knocked him out of presidential contention, in the opinion of liberal Democratic Congressman Emanuel Seller of Brooklyn. "I think the nation itself has come to realize he is not a shining white knight." There were so many gaps in Senator Kennedy's cunning TV speech that it causes us to lose considerable confidence in Teddy Kennedy. As a result of the accident, pressures pushing Senator Kennedy toward a presidential candidacy had subsided, Mike Mansfield confirmed. "I never thought he'd run in 1972 unless he bowed to the pressures that built up. Now I feel more certain than ever that he won't run." Before Chappaquiddick, Kennedy could have had the nomination for the asking, Senator Edmund Muskie said. The controversy may have brought about an unfortunate shift in his fortunes. Muskie, a Maine Democrat with his own presidential ambitions, would not operate on the assumption that Ted Kennedy's troubles, and I suppose he has troubles, would be of any political advantage to me. I wish him well in every way. It was premature to write off the senator's future. "I would never count a Kennedy out of anything," Muskie said. The continuing tragedy and phenomenon of the Kennedy family did not lend itself to common measurement. With neither Kennedy nor his friends planning to say anything more about the accident, in the face of demands by almost every major newspaper for clarification, the press that had played so large a part in the success of the Kennedy dynasty was now more solidly and righteously anti-EMK than perhaps any other element in the political community, columnists Evans and Novak observed. So long as Kennedy remained silent about the accident's unanswered questions, he risked a hostile press. As a result, most politicians read EMK out of the 1972 presidential race. He may be out of the presidential picture for good. His entire political career hangs in the balance. The collapse of Ted Kennedy's presidential chances, however, was suggesting a possible escape route out of the dilemma of Chappaquiddick. A poll published by the Boston Globe on Tuesday, July 28th, revealed 78% of Massachusetts voters wanted Ted Kennedy to retain his Senate seat. Although 56% believed he'd left a number of questions about the accident unanswered, an NBC-sponsored survey revealed the next day that 81% of his constituents wanted Kennedy to remain in office. As presidential preference, however, Kennedy's position had dropped from a pre-accident high of 72% to 55%. Advisors at the compound concluded from that result that a first step toward his political rehabilitation would be to take himself out of presidential contention in 1972, a fact that appeared already a fait accompli. Withdrawal from the presidential race, combined with an expression of interest in remaining in the Senate, should, in their view, end the harassment in the press about a new investigation into the accident. No decision had been made on Tuesday, when the senator cruised Nantucket Sound aboard the Marlin, then went fishing from the breakwater in Hyannisport. But Kennedy could not afford to dawdle in the expectation of a tide of public support rising up against the implacable criticism in the press. Editorials and cartoons were getting worse. Kennedy was not an unfortunate man confessing panic and poor judgment in his speech, but a personage engaged in an elaborately devious piece of stagecraft. The surge of public support was falling off. Western Union officials confirmed earlier estimates of messages sent to the senator to be well below the 100,000 mark previously announced. The senator was reading many of the messages to help him decide about resignation, Dick Drain said. Whether he will say yes or no isn't known. But Kennedy's appeal to constituents had reduced the credibility of his resignation talk. The longer the decision hovered, the less likely it was anyone would believe he ever considered resigning. A source close to the decision later claimed the suspense about the senator's intentions had been a Kennedy-created sham. There was never any essential doubt about resignation. It was just a matter of timing the statement to announce his return to the Senate. The editorial furor, the letters and telegrams, had played no part in the matter. Kennedy had determined from the start, "I've just got to gut this thing through." Chapter 35. Of the first 400 letters opened at the senator's Boston office on Wednesday morning, only three or four were anti-Kennedy, aide Jim King revealed. Because the senator had expressed the wish to see everything that came into the office, the mail was being forwarded to Hyannisport. The senator was heartened and encouraged by such messages of support, but King didn't know how long he would take to decide whether to resign. Dick Drane, too, persisted in the claim that resignation was possible, he said. "I have no reason to believe the senator has made any decision, or if he has, communicated it to anyone." Kennedy ended his self-imposed exile, boarding a plane at Barnstable County Airport in Hyannis at 1 o'clock, to fly to the funeral of Burke Marshall's father in Plainfield, New Jersey. It was then that his Boston office distributed mimeographed copies of a statement to reporters. "Senator Edward M. Kennedy is returning to Washington to resume his duties as United States Senator and Assistant Majority Leader. He is grateful to the people of Massachusetts for their expressions of confidence and expects to submit his record to them as a candidate for re-election in 1970. If re-elected, he will serve out his entire 6-year term." Dick Drane refused to say if the senator was foregoing a run for the presidency in 1972. "I don't interpret the senator's statements," he said. "It seems unambiguous to me." Kennedy did not plan to hold a press conference or to submit to questions about the accident. His speedy response to an appeal to Massachusetts voters suggested to the New York Times a carefully worked out plan to reestablish his political position in the eyes of the voters of his state, based upon a partially irrelevant and totally unsatisfactory ex parte account of the accident. "There are so many gaping holes in the story, which he has so assiduously avoided filling. There is such an unmistakable atmosphere of calculated evaluation for maximum, or as the case may be, minimum, public effect, that we cannot consider the matter to have been satisfactorily resolved in any sense." Joseph Kopechne approved of Kennedy's decision to return to the Senate, but considered his week of silence about the accident ill-advised. "I think he was getting poor advice. I really do." Kopechne had yet to come to grips with his daughter's death. He said, "I still can't believe it's happened, even now. It's like watching a TV program and turning it off and it's all over." Gwen Kopechne continued to think of her daughter in the present, not in the past. "We still expect her to come home, to walk through that door. We haven't had time to think and form any opinion of what is going on around us. When it really hits us, it will be too late." Mrs. Kopechne did not hold Senator Kennedy personally responsible for her daughter's death and harbored no hard feelings toward him, she said. "Mr. Kopechne and I can form no hate for anyone. There's always something good in a person, no matter what his faults. Nothing can help us with our daughter now. No one can bring her back or console us. This could have happened to any one of those girls. It just so happened it was Mary Jo. It was an unfortunate accident. We want to believe this." Senator Kennedy's return to the Senate had left Edgartown with the physical and figurative debris of its notoriety, the Vineyard Gazette observed. Portions of Dyke Bridge had been broken away for souvenirs. Tourists continued to pose for snapshots at the split-rail fence in front of the Lawrence Cottage, and reporters returned for second-look stories. All of them are bothered and intrigued that the known facts of the case do not add up to a complete picture of the accident. Kennedy's intention not to say anything more about the incident brought new and heavy pressures on the district attorney's office. "For the past 3 weeks, Denise had been deeply troubled," he said. "Miss Kopechne was dead. Senator Kennedy said he was involved. I had a choice of conducting an investigation myself or letting the local authorities do it. Denise had no doubt the proper course was to leave the matter in the hands of the local police and medical examiner. But as the days went by and no new information came to light, I began to distrust my own motives. I began to ask myself if my admiration of the Kennedys and my sympathy for Senator Kennedy's personal situation were preventing me from carrying out my duty as district attorney. Had my decision to take no action been based on a misguided deference to the senator's high station? Clearly I had to call my own courage into account. On Wednesday night, Denise decided he could stay out of the case no longer. A human being was dead. I was not satisfied that all pertinent facts had been told, he said, and it was my duty as a representative of the people of my district to demand an inquest. Senator Kennedy looked tanned, rested, and apparently recovered from whatever injuries he had suffered in his accident when he stepped into a crush of tourists and reporters awaiting his arrival at the Capitol on Thursday morning. Reporters wanted to know if the statement released the previous day meant he'd eliminated himself as a candidate for president in 1972. "That's right. I intend to fill out my full term if reelected," Kennedy said, and brushed aside other questions to hurry up the Capitol steps. Kennedy waited in an anteroom of the Senate until Majority Leader Mike Mansfield showed up. Then he entered the chamber. Mansfield said, "Come in here, Ted. Right back where you belong." Taking Kennedy's arm, Mansfield escorted him to the front row whip's desk, a ritual of re-entry as obvious to those crowded into the gallery, as was the senator's subdued and ill-at-ease manner. Throughout the morning session, members of both parties approached his desk to shake hands, pat his shoulder, and murmur words of welcome. Kennedy reaffirmed his decision not to run for president in 1972 on his way to lunch. "The statement that I made was precise in saying to the people of Massachusetts, who have been so responsive, that I would serve my full term." Kennedy intended to say no more about the accident, he said. "I tried to the very best of my ability, in the reports that have been made, to give the facts of the accident. I wouldn't have any further comment." So dark a cloud of doubt and mystery hovering over the incident, and the appearance of a calculated suppression of many details, was a powerful argument for Senator Kennedy to abandon his attention not to say anything more about the episode, in the view of the Washington Post. Because it is crucial for the senator to dispel the impression given by his silence that there is something he is trying to hide. Kennedy's silence was compelling evidence in support of the ugly suggestion that there was, and still is, a careful, cold-blooded conspiracy to cover something up. A suspicion that, as things stand, is easily arrived at. Jimmy Smith regretted the price of the presidency appeared to have been paid as a result of the serious mismanagement of the crisis by a clique of advisors at the compound. Smith was glad, "You're back at work and the ordeal is over." He wrote Kennedy on Thursday, July 31st, to express how I feel and where I stand, and that you know you can count on me now and any time in the future. Smith had talked to Joe Gargan and asked him to relay messages to you during the past 2 weeks. I hope they helped. Disappointed that his mediation efforts between the district attorney's office and the compound had not been able to avert a disaster, Smith wanted Kennedy to know, "Ed Denise proved to be a true friend. I'll explain when I see you." But Smith's assurances were hollow. He didn't know what Denise was doing. On the day of Smith's soothing letter, Denise was asking Joseph Toro, Chief Justice of the Superior Court, to assign a judge to conduct an inquest into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, who supposedly died by external means on or about July 18, 1969. Later that afternoon, the district attorney's office released the text of the Denise letter, without comment. Word of the reopening of an investigation into the accident at Chappaquiddick struck Kennedy's office like a thunderbolt, only hours after the senator had resumed his seat. Dick Drane learned of the Denise letter when the Boston Bureau of the Associated Press telephoned for reaction. Summoned from the Senate floor, Kennedy was reported to have blown his top. at the revival of a crisis thought to have been disarmed. Chapter 36. The senator would have no comment on the Denise letter, Drane announced, before a call from Kennedy's office went out to Judge Toro in Boston. Toro was outraged the letter had been made public before he received it. It is very bad judgment, at the least, on District Attorney Denise's part, to disclose information of this sort without first notifying the court. Toro refused comment until he received the letter, which arrived by special delivery the next morning. Toro dismissed the request out of hand. No provision of law permitted the Superior Court to conduct inquests, he said. All relevant statutes clearly indicate that the District Court has exclusive jurisdiction over such proceedings. Toro scorned Denise for the confusion and misconceptions you have created in the minds of many regarding the judicial process. I do believe it is incumbent upon you to state the reason for your unusual and unprecedented action. Denise took Toro's rebuke in stride. He had no quarrel with the Chief Justice and was following his advice. The law on inquest was ambiguous about jurisdiction. While unprecedented, his request to the Superior Court had been attempted anyway. To express my preference of courts to conduct the inquiry. District Court judges are appointed for life to serve in their community. Superior Court judges travel around. I like that better, Denise said, with disarmingly cavalier disregard for proper procedure. Denise sent his request to Kenneth Nash, Chief Justice of the District Court. While district attorneys might request them, inquests are practically obsolete, Nash said. An inquest did not have the power of indictment. All it can do is recommend to a district attorney that grand jury action is advisable. A grand jury was used to ascertain the existence of a crime and the parties accused of doing it. An inquest was limited to the question of whether a crime had been committed. The difference was, a judge is trained on determining legal causation. Grand juries aren't. Denise may have hesitated to apply to Judge Nash following Denise's highly publicized accusations that the Massachusetts District Court system was among the most corrupt systems in the world because judges sit for life on one bench and exercise personal prejudices daily. Nash had considered the source in disdaining the charges as hardly worth an answer. He said, I'll challenge Mr. Denise to name one corrupt judge in the system. But he can't. Denise should have filed his request with the presiding judge of the district court at Edgartown, Nash explained. Judge Boyle would probably disqualify himself from presiding at an inquest, having imposed a suspended sentence for leaving the scene and delivered himself of the extrajudicial opinion that Senator Kennedy had been punished far beyond anything this court can impose. Denise had not followed the established procedure of consulting local officials who were familiar with the case before asking for an inquest, Walter Steele said. We have had no discussion at all with Mr. Denise since Senator Kennedy pleaded guilty. Steele was willing to sit down and talk rationally with the district attorney about evidence in the case, but he would oppose an inquest if I had any officials standing to do that. Steele didn't think a new inquiry would produce any evidence of other crimes. An inquest could resolve a number of unanswered questions about the accident that had aroused public curiosity, Arena said. He was surprised Denise hadn't informed him of his request in advance, or explained why he felt an inquest in the case was necessary. After all, he is my district attorney. Nettled by criticism that his handling of the case might have provoked demands for a new investigation, and still sensitive about his failure to have questioned persons who had attended the party, with the exception of Jack Crimmins, Arena wanted it to be known that he had interviewed a number of them, and so had Walter Steele. Although the questioning did not develop any evidence to support new charges, it helped dispel some of the rumors about the case, Arena told the New York Daily News. Arena's questioning had turned up no new evidence of excessive drinking at the party, nor information to support speculation that Senator Kennedy had conspired for a time to hide the fact he was driving the accident car. His interrogations had failed to clear up one mystery in the case. No one at the party to whom Arena talked could pinpoint the exact time Senator Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne had left the party. An embarrassed Arena later confessed, "Maybe we were just trying to cover our asses or something, but that story is inaccurate. We only talked to Jack Crimmins. We never got to the other party people at all." Arena's offer to help in the new investigation went unacknowledged. The district attorney had shown no interest in Edgartown police files, he said. There's no rapport between the two offices. As a first step in the investigation, Denise ordered the accident car impounded as evidence. Bernie Flynn supervised the removal from the Depot Corner garage to state police barracks in Oak Bluffs. Shrouded in tarpaulin, the car had been stripped by souvenir seekers of three ashtrays, the gas cap and pedal, pieces of shattered windshield and chrome trim. Flynn didn't think the car would provide much in the way of evidence and was dubious about a new investigation. Denise didn't want to go after the case at all. He was so scared of it, he wasn't answering his phone. He was forced by the press, baying at his heels, to do something. So, being a politician, he could see the handwriting on the wall, Flynn said. Had he been smart, he would have kept hands off like Killen told him to. Killen was fit to be tied and mad as hell when he got word of the Denise letter. In Killen's view, Denise was upset at criticism in the press and had caved in to pressure. An inquest was as much to defend Denise's own reputation as to investigate Senator Kennedy's accident. Frank Keating thought there might be another reason the district attorney got involved. One thing about Denise, there was no hanky-panky with drunk driving cases. And that was strictly and solely because of publicity. If anything ever happened to a case that was going down the drain, it was going to reflect on him. And Denise wasn't about to give that up for drunks. He had that scathing attitude about anybody who drank, because he never drank himself to any degree. The press had been pounding away with speculation that Ted Kennedy had been drinking at the time of the accident, needling Denise into action. Keating was curious to see if the matter ever went to trial. It wasn't the kind of case Denise would assign anybody. He'd handle it personally, he said. I figured he'd fall flat on his face. He was hopeless trying cases. He never knew anything, because he'd never take the time to prepare. But Jimmy Smith commended the district attorney's conduct entirely. Denise had been unfairly criticized for following the dictates of his office by staying out of the Kennedy accident. Eddie turned sour when he was hammered and ridiculed by the press. He went into a rage, then he attacked, like he usually does, Smith said. Errors of judgment on the part of Ted Kennedy's advisors had been responsible for a reopened investigation. Denise was being kind, and they didn't take his kindness, Smith said. The arrogance of Kennedy's staff had prevented even so much as a telephone call to acknowledge what Denise had tried to do. Smith was grateful Denise hadn't taken the case before a grand jury. If he'd done that, they would have bagged it, and it would have been all over. Denise was amused when Smith told him he didn't want anything to do with the inquest. He said, "We didn't have any plans for you to be involved." With the inquest letter, "I was put in a back room," Smith said. "They were afraid I'd surface, so they had me tucked away." George Killen wasn't concerned the press would discover the Kennedy connection in his office, so much as the focus of the case had moved to New Bedford and he'd lost control. When Denise announced a press conference, "To state clearly the reason why I have called for a judicial inquest into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne," Killen was reminded of the debacle the previous March. Denise had made such inflammatory remarks at a news conference to announce the arrest of murderer Anton Costa that defense attorneys had won injunctive relief following some of the most sordid pretrial publicity ever released to the press by investigative agencies. It was the first time an order for restraint had been brought by a district court. Killen urged Denise not to discuss the Kennedy accident in public and fan the flames of controversy any higher than they were already. Denise called off the press conference as reporters were already gathering, so as to allow his letter to reach the district court for a ruling. In the statement he had prepared for the press conference, but which was never released, Denise explained that his request for an inquest had not been based on the uncovering of new evidence, but rather on the lack of information that would allow me to remain out of the case with a clear conscience, Denise said. The purpose of my action is to find the truth. Only a full disclosure of all the facts will allow us to lay this case, with all of its pain, finally to rest. To deflect criticism that an inquest had in any way been invited because of the unavailability of witnesses, three young women who had attended the party at Chappaquiddick complained to the New York Times that they had yet to be approached by Massachusetts authorities to give statements about the accident. The senator's office confirmed that two other young women and five men at the party hadn't been contacted by police either. Senator Kennedy was canceling a speech before the World of Youth Council in Liège, Belgium. He doesn't feel now is the time to travel in Europe, Dick Drain said. Kennedy wanted to be available in case his presence was required. But he doesn't understand why Denise is asking for an inquest. Kennedy told reporters on the Senate floor, "It's still rather unclear as to the nature of it. I plan to cooperate in any way." But he was clearly dismayed by a reopened inquiry into his accident. It had been his understanding. After I accepted the responsibility and appeared in a court of law, there wouldn't be any further kinds of legal action. If Kennedy didn't understand why Denise asked for an inquest, he was among the few in Washington who didn't. The common sense and common conscience of the American people rejected the senator's explanation of the accident, columnist James Reston wrote. An inquest should be welcomed by the general public, and especially by Senator Kennedy himself, according to a WCBS radio editorial. Even the most partisan of Senator Kennedy's supporters should be disturbed by the ugly suspicion that a conspiracy of official silence has surrounded the tragedy. Vital questions had been left unanswered, and material witnesses permitted to go unquestioned by police. Kennedy's televised explanation had been at once self-pitying and unsatisfactory in many respects. There is about the whole incident an unpleasant aura of protected privilege. Senator Kennedy and every other witness who will be called to testify must be prepared to give honest answers to the searching questions that remain to be asked. The resumption of the crisis was very much on the minds of reporters at Logan Airport in Boston, who met Senator Kennedy on his way to Cape Cod for the weekend. Asked if he thought the move to seek an inquest smacked of an attempt to get publicity, Kennedy replied, "No, I wouldn't categorize that of Mr. Denise. I think he has a responsibility. I respect him for fulfilling his responsibilities. I'm just hopeful we can get back to work and get back to the Senate." The next day, however, sources close to Kennedy charged Denise was trying to turn tragedy into a political windfall. But Denise recognized, politically, this is not good for me. This is the home state of the Kennedys, and they are loved. How can anyone who is involved in prosecuting or investigating them come out with any advantage? Denise's assessment was based upon years in pursuit of elected office as heir to a modest political dynasty, founded by his father, Jacinto Giniz. A native of the Azores, the elder Giniz had emigrated to Fall River, served in the U.S. Army in World War I, then taken up a career in public service. A tireless advocate of social legislation to benefit the poor immigrants, who made up the majority of his supporters in the 8th Bristol District, Giniz was the stormy petrel of the State House, one of the most controversial personages ever to debate an issue on the floor of Beacon Hill, in which he had one day appeared wrapped in the Portuguese flag. Edmundo, he later changed it to Edmund Denise, Giniz, had learned his father's trade in a household where politics was not only a preoccupation, but a requirement for survival, Armand Fernandez said. If his father lost an election, there wasn't food on the table. Giniz died of a heart attack at a political rally in 1949, but not before his 24-year-old son had succeeded to his seat in the State House, a political wunderkind summoned from classes at Suffolk University Law School to the legislature for roll call votes. A former city councilman and state senator, Denise was, at 34, elected the youngest district attorney in Massachusetts. Re-elected in 1962, he ran unopposed in 1966. A delegate to the 1956 Democratic Convention, Denise had escorted John F. Kennedy to the rostrum to accept nomination as vice president, and wholeheartedly supported his election in 1960. Denise displayed in his law office a pastel portrait of John Kennedy, alongside photographs of his other political heroes, James Michael Curley, former mayor of Boston, who served part of his term in a federal penitentiary, former President Franklin D. Roosevelt, and the late British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. Ted Kennedy's Senate candidacy in 1962 had placed Denise's standing in the Kennedy political network in jeopardy. Denise resented the arm-twisting for-us-or-against-us demand by Kennedy operatives for his support during a bitterly fought primary against Edward McCormick, nephew of House Speaker John McCormick. When Denise had sought to fulfill his father's wish to be buried at Arlington National Cemetery, John McCormick had made the arrangements. Denise felt he owed him. His support of Edward McCormick inevitably cost him in the powerful Kennedy camp. To this was added a growing reputation as an outspoken political maverick of unpredictable and mercurial temperament, chronically embroiled in public controversies. Denise attacked the probate court as a little-known citadel of judicial patronage and favoritism, operating in an atmosphere of intimidation. The jury selection system, he charged, was absolutely discriminatory, and a systematic denial of justice throughout Massachusetts. Most aggravating of all had been Denise's inability to extend his political horizons beyond the precincts of New Bedford. Seeking to unseat Republican Margaret Heckler in the U.S. House of Representatives in 1968, Denise was criticized for misrepresenting his record. Then-State Attorney General Elliot Richardson had warned the Kennedys not to support Denise, charging widespread, notorious, and systematic criminal offenses occurring in Denise's district. Richardson called a special grand jury to investigate police corruption in Bristol County. Denise reacted by ascribing the probe to Richardson's record of motor vehicle violations, including several drunk driving convictions. Ted Kennedy had campaigned on behalf of other Massachusetts Democratic House candidates facing tough competition, but he stayed away from New Bedford. Publicly, Denise said nothing about the lack of Kennedy backing, but blamed his crushing defeat on insufficient funds and two editorials in the New Bedford Standard Times. According to the newspaper, Denise had displayed more vigor outside the district attorney's office in developing his private law practice and extensive real estate interests. A newly acquired insurance agency had pursued business so aggressively, Denise was censured for unethical solicitation by the State Department of Banking and Insurance, and was in possible conflict of interest. Since Denise was entrusted with the prosecution of violators of motor vehicle statutes, he can decide not to move against drivers who bring their insurance business to him. Denise scorned the newspaper as John Birch-oriented and regretted that candidates must live with irresponsible editorial writers with their lies and innuendos. Although he was handsome, likable, articulate, and on occasion straight-talking, Denise had failed to attract the favorable notice of the leaders of the Massachusetts Democratic Party in Boston. Denise, in turn, branded them as a small clique of Star Chamber coat holders. He said, "I think for the most part it's that I go my own way. I don't spend time to cultivate them, and I couldn't care less." A mural blow-up of a campaign photograph greeted reporters in the stairwell of Denise's second-floor law and insurance offices when they sought out the district attorney. "I am controversial, and have been ever since I entered politics 20 years ago," Denise conceded. "Sometimes I may have been wrong, but at least I have gone along doing what I thought was right." The primary duty of the district attorney's office was not to convict, he added, but to see that justice is done. This, then, was the man poised to plunge into a controversy without precedent in an already stormy career. Chapter 37. Gargan wasn't surprised Denise had asked for a new investigation. I wasn't confident at the time the senator pleaded guilty in Edgartown that would be the end of the matter, particularly with all the publicity the case was getting. The senator's report of the accident had been composed in haste and ill-advised. A week of deliberations at the compound had produced a speech under the stress of an impatient and increasingly skeptical press. But making unsworn statements to police and delivering a ghost-written exegesis on television was one thing. Repeating them at an inquest was another. To repudiate either statement was to admit having lied. To repeat lies for the sake of consistency under oath risked perjury. Senator Kennedy would have to tread carefully around his previous words, Gargan reflected, while at the same time making sure he maintained the same position. It had never been anticipated the senator would be called upon to provide sworn testimony about the accident, a major consideration in his decision to plead guilty to leaving the scene. Stephen Smith now took over the direct management of a crisis that no longer could be delegated to others, to deal with an inquest he scorned as an imprecise process devoted primarily to train accidents that hasn't been used in Massachusetts since, I don't know, never. Steve Smith sort of came to dominate things after a while, a participant in the strategy sessions at Hyannisport observed. He decided at the compound that the girls shouldn't be left high and dry. Smith had expressed the view, "These kids came up here all alone, not a soul to look out for them. So we've got to watch out for their interests." Smith later denied playing any part in retaining lawyers for the young women as a means of coordinating their testimony and to fend off reporters and investigators because of what the girls might be asked about or get into. That idea had come from their mothers, expressing some concern about what was going to happen to then-daughters. Senator Kennedy explained, "After an inquest was called for, there appeared to be some necessity to retain counsel. I felt they were innocent individuals who, as a result of my action, were being brought into court. I felt some responsibility to at least offer some compensation. Arrangements were made by which I paid their attorneys." Judge Clark recommended that his friend Daniel Daly represent Ray LaRosa, Jack Crimmins, and Charles Tretter, as well as the young women of the boiler room. Reportedly, one of the first actions the attorneys took was to instruct the women not to discuss the case with reporters or police. Clark was shutting off other avenues of information. He advised Registrar McLaughlin to cancel a scheduled hearing into the accident. Clark wanted no determination of serious fault made on the record that could prejudice the inquest by suggesting negligence to a presiding judge. On September 11th, Registry Inspector Joseph Grealish confirmed by telephone that the hearing was being postponed until such time as the final outcome of proceedings now pending. Grealish was instructed to reschedule the hearing for Wednesday, May 6, 1970, at 10 a.m., more than 10 months after the accident. McLaughlin had the Chappaquiddick file in a locked drawer in his office desk to prevent subordinates from leaking information to reporters. An interagency memorandum warned, "We have already made all the comment in this case that we legally can." If the accident had provided anybody with a political windfall, it was McLaughlin. His term of office was due to expire on December 17th. He and other holdover Democratic appointees were not expected to be renamed by Republican Governor Francis Sargent. By his assiduous accommodation on the case, McLaughlin was gathering up leverage to keep his job. The Kennedy political apparatus in Massachusetts would not want a Republican appointee dealing with the sensitive Chappaquiddick case. In contrast to the week following the accident, there was no rush of Jack Kennedy's new frontiersmen to the compound. Most conspicuously absent was Ted Sorensen, principal author of the now-regretted television speech. Mention of a possible inquest had been sufficient to send Sorensen on television to moralize about Senator Kennedy's predicament and clarify his role in the affair. As Senator Kennedy himself has declared, his conduct that night was inexplicable, Sorensen said. He should have gone back and gotten help that night, now that he looks back on it. Of course he should have. Anger that Kennedy's staff was blaming the speech for the doubts about the case, which had prompted a new investigation, Sorensen was protecting himself, in the event an inquest uncovered any deception he was not aware of in the speech. He said, "To the best of my knowledge, there are no misstatements of facts." The accident had damaged, if not destroyed, Ted Kennedy's prospects for the Democratic presidential nomination, Sorensen said. "And I don't think that that being so recent in the minds of the public, and that being so clear an indication of his action under pressure at this stage of his life, that he should try for the presidency in 1972. Ted Kennedy was so young. He could run for president as late as 1988 when he was 56 years old. But no one could predict with certainty what his political future was. What happened at the inquest would tell whether Kennedy could ever run for president. William Vanden Heuvel, the former Bobby Kennedy aide dispatched to handhold the Kopechnys, criticized as unprofessional Sorensen's public remarks about the accident. Sorensen and Vanden Heuvel were rumored to be rivals for the Democratic nomination to run for Robert Kennedy's former Senate seat from New York in 1970, a contest Sorensen was actively considering. Drafting Kennedy's speech about the accident, however, had hurt his candidacy, Sorensen said. "There's no doubt it has diminished my chances. By how much, we don't know yet." The accident not only threatened Sorensen's embryonic political career, but necessitated last-minute changes in the bound galleys of The Kennedy Legacy, a book in which author Sorensen intended to anoint himself as elder statesman of the new frontier. Sorensen now deleted all references to Teddy Kennedy running for president in 1972 and recast the framework of his book in light of these two remarkable brothers, John and Robert Kennedy. "The legacy of the two Kennedys," he wrote, "did not depend on their surviving brother being elected president for it to endure." Sorensen denied that the accident at Chappaquiddick marked the end of the Kennedy era. In all, he virtually disinherited Ted Kennedy from his family's political heritage. But Chappaquiddick tarnished the luster of that legacy. Hostile critics perceived disturbing similarities in the handling of the accident with the Kennedy White House style. The eagerness to put off hard decisions as long as possible, the absorption in secondary issues, the belief that rhetoric is enough, and the heavy dependency on borrowed judgments of idea men and speechwriters. Sorensen was not alone among New Frontiersmen distancing themselves from Teddy Kennedy because of Chappaquiddick. Frank Mankiewicz, former press secretary to Robert Kennedy, characterized the episode as a tragedy in the Shakespearean sense of a puzzlement of the will, of judgment suspended and flawed at a crucial moment. Even before the accident, Ted Kennedy was exhibiting a moodiness and disorientation that worried friends, demonstrating to some observers an emotional escapism and volatility that betrayed the absence of a central core of integrity. But those elder statesman defections pleased Ted Kennedy's bushy-tailed staff, unhappy when the boss went outside for prestigious advice. In their view, part of the problem was due to an older generation of Kennedy men, whose printout was at least 10 years old. Sorensen's soaring Ciceronian phrases had acquired a fustian dust. This crisis called for a harder, more pragmatic approach. The strain Kennedy was under was evident when he left Cape Cod early Sunday to greet President Nixon on his return from an 8-nation foreign policy tour at Andrews Air Force Base in Washington. The president stopped to shake Kennedy's hand and extend an invitation to the White House for a briefing of cabinet members and congressional leaders about his trip. Receiving him with almost paternal sympathy, Nixon took Kennedy aside for a private 10-minute talk in the Oval Room. Nixon had experienced premature political burial himself and achieved a remarkable comeback 6 years later. Nixon refused to say what he told Senator Kennedy or to comment on the accident at Chappaquiddick. "I don't know anything about it," he said. But in anticipation of a possible Kennedy challenge in 1972, a surveillance of the senator had been instigated, and a private investigator was dispatched to Edgartown to gather intelligence about the accident. The major threat to Nixon's re-election had disappeared in a cloud of scandal, so tainting the Kennedy mystique. It is doubtful that the Kennedy name for some time to come will have its former appeal. With the passage of weeks, a high degree of skepticism about the senator's explanation of the accident and his behavior afterward had produced a sharp drop in Kennedy's popularity, a national Lou Harris poll reported. Much of the doubt is focused upon whether or not Kennedy was drunk at the time of the accident. Public perception of the event reflected upon Kennedy's aptitude for the White House, that he had panicked in a crisis and showed that he could not be given high public trust, such as being president. Unless Kennedy answered all questions about the incident, he would raise ineradicable doubts about his fitness for the presidency. And the public will continue to question his ability to make important decisions under pressure. If there was one aspect about the accident more mysterious than any other, it was that, despite the damage done to his reputation, Kennedy refused to clear the air, writer Robert Sherrill observed. Painful as his slippage in popularity and the raw jokes were, Kennedy apparently preferred them to making a full disclosure. While full disclosure was unlikely, Judge Clark warned the conferees at the compound the new investigation would be no amateur affair, like Arena and Steele had conducted in Edgartown. Chief investigator in the district attorney's office was George Killen, an experienced detective. Clark knew from personal experience of Killen's abilities. He had locked horns with him in several cases he had defended on Cape Cod. Killen was an able investigator, meticulous in the preparation of cases for prosecution in the Barnstable Court. In Killen's office was Bernie Flynn, a tough and resourceful police officer. Together, they had cracked the Costa murders, second only to the Boston Strangler case, in the annals of famous contemporary crimes in Massachusetts. On Monday, August 4th, George Killen and Bernie Flynn arrived in Edgartown to begin their official investigation into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. "They wanted the names of my witnesses and copies of the reports and everything else," Arena recalled. But George and Bernie did everything on their own. Arena's investigation was practically worthless to Killen. The case as cold as Mary Jo Kopechne, or colder. A lot of leads had dried up since Ted Kennedy's police report. Most of all, Killen regretted the decision to release the body without autopsy, Flynn said. George was kicking his own ass about that. Every day he's saying, "We should have done an autopsy." Flynn was amused by the sign on display behind the front desk of the Shiretown Inn. "Please do not ask us to answer questions concerning the Kennedy accident. Thank you, the management." Besieged since he came forward to corroborate a portion of the senator's broadcast, Russell Peachey was having second thoughts about his encounter with Ted Kennedy. "He didn't look to me like a man who had come downstairs to complain about noise," Peachey said. "He was just standing there. He was fully dressed. I think he was wearing a jacket and slacks. Usually a man who just wants to complain about noise doesn't get up and get fully dressed to do it, especially at 2:25 in the morning." Reservations for seven people of the Kennedy party had been made under the names of John Driscoll and Joe Gargan for the regatta weekend. The room adjacent to Senator Kennedy's had been occupied by Ross Richards. Peachey described Richards as a friend and sailing companion of Ted Kennedy. Chapter 38. Killen dispatched Detective Lieutenant John Dunn to Rumford, Rhode Island to interrogate Richards, and later came to regret that he did. Dunn was a thorn in Killen's side. A former Boston motorcycle traffic cop employed by the fire marshal's office in Springfield after joining the state police, Dunn had invoked seniority to win assignment to Killen's office. Killen tried to block Dunn's assignment because he wanted Bernie Flynn and not an inexperienced investigator working for him. But a state police review board backed Dunn. Killen had to pull Dunn off the Costa murder case when, in his judgment, Dunn botched the initial investigation. Killen referred to him as that dopey son of a bitch. Nevertheless, Dunn was in his office to stay. If anybody was going to have to go, it was going to be Flynn. Vice president in charge of production for the Narragansett Wire Company, Ross Richards, was a hard-driving, dynamic sportsman. Richards had photographs of himself with Ted Kennedy on display in his living room. But his feelings about the senator were ambivalent, Marilyn Richard said. Ross wasn't a member of the inner circle around Ted, because he wasn't a political person. We were strictly sailing friends. We got invited to the compound on occasion for social things, but we weren't close. Ross had grown up in Hyannisport. He and Ted had sailed against each other for years.